Shoreshine Podcast, shining a light to the nations.
Hello, everybody. This is Bill, and this is our teaching on the Torah portion called Vayikra. Vayikra, and he called. And this Torah portion, of course, is going to begin at the very beginning of the book of Leviticus, also called Vayikra, chapter 1, verse 1 through chapter 5, verse 26. Now, as we begin, let's just talk about a few little details here before we actually get into the verses. But first of all, I thought you might be interested to know that the oldest name for this book is Torat HaKohenim, literally Instructions for the Priests, because this book, Leviticus, or Vayikra, is going to deal primarily with the function of the priesthood and the duties of the priestly nation, that is Israel, of course. And the current Hebrew name, Vayikra, is derived from the very first word of the first verse, Vayikra, thus Vayikra. Now, the name that we're most accustomed to, Leviticus, is derived from the Septuagint, which, of course, is a Greek translation of the Hebrew text. And so, Levi, you can see the word there, Leviticus, it's talking about all of the instructions that were given to the Levites, the sons of Aaron, etc. Now, one half of this book is going to deal with sacrifices and all the accompanying laws for those sacrifices. The other half of the book is going to deal with holiness, and it's going to deal with the sanctification of life. Of course, we're going to be getting into those different details in the coming weeks. And what we'll see is, if you haven't already noticed this in past readings, that the book of Leviticus or Vayikra is almost completely devoid of any kind of narrative. It's mostly instruction. For that reason, a lot of people, Christians, in other words, have tended to ignore the book of Leviticus or skip over it when they're reading through the book, just not paying a lot of attention to it, because it really, and especially in these first few chapters that we're going to see, it essentially forms a manual for the ritual of sacrifice for Israel and how the priests were to carry these things out. Now, for that reason, many Christians just ignore it. But what we want to see is that most of these sacrifices, and at least in this Torah portion, deal for the most part with voluntary private sacrifices, not necessarily mandatory, but voluntary sacrifices. And that right there is a key to us as we get into this and as we look at some of these things. Now, when we do read about the different sacrifices, a lot of it is not explained. In other words, the concept of sacrifice is not explained. Why do you have to sacrifice? It gets into what you do when you sacrifice, how you're to go about it, but it doesn't really explain why you're sacrificing. In part because sacrifice was familiar to everyone, and so consequently it is presupposed that you understand the concept of sacrifice, which is to be, like prayer, an expression of your devotion to God. And this would apply as not only for Israel, but other nations and other cultures were familiar with the concept of sacrifices as an expression of your devotion. But what we're going to see in Vayikra and through the rest of the book of Leviticus is that the Creator, the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, distinguishes Israel from the rest of the world and from all the other peoples, even in how they approach their God. Now, I will admit, and I think most of us would have to, that sacrifice in the way we see it explained for us or detailed for us in the book of Leviticus, it's hard for men to grasp the function and the purpose of it rationally, because we can't understand why the slaughter and the burning of an animal, and then its blood poured on an altar, is going to invite the presence of God. But is it possible that the reasons are so profound that it escapes our comprehension even unto this day? In other words, we don't believe that God needed these sacrifices because he owns the cattle on 1,000 hills. We don't believe he has a bloodlust No, because we know that God is love and that God is all about life. And yet he does detail through Vayikra and other portions of the book of Leviticus the fact that these sacrifices, many of them voluntary, some of them mandatory, were an integral part of Israel coming into his presence and he remaining in theirs. But when we look at sacrifices, again, it's typical for people to look at the blood, the gore, and all those kinds of things and wonder why God would ask for such. And there are those who would accuse him of being a bloodthirsty God. But we know, as his followers, that he is not bloodthirsty. He's all about life. And actually, these sacrifices remind us of his mercy in that an animal is permitted to substitute for me because it is my sin and it's my transgression that has to be dealt with and that this animal is going to substitute because actually God is permitting the animal to be substituted so that I don't have to die on that altar. And then when we begin to comprehend that concept, then we see the magnitude of Yeshua's sacrifice. But we'll talk about that in more detail later. Now, with very few exceptions, deliberate sin is excluded from the sphere of sacrifice. In other words, most of all of these different sacrifices are going to do with involuntary or unintentional, I should say, things that were done, and in some cases without you even really understanding that you have committed a transgression. But in all cases, repentance and restitution is going to have to precede the sacrificial act. In other words, before you bring your gift, you have to deal with the issue of your heart. You have to deal with the issue of repentance. And if restitution needs to be made, then it must precede the sacrificial act, which again, truly accentuates the work of the Messiah because he is our sacrifice. Now, even though there's many people in the believing world, in the Christian world, or whatever terminology works for you, there are a lot of people, again, who will ignore these sacrifices. But these different sacrifices teach us lessons, many lessons. And just as we kind of get going here, just a few examples. One, for instance, comes from the olah. The olah is the burnt offering. And what this is to express to us is complete surrender to God's will, not halfway, but complete, because the burnt offering is a total offering. Everything's consumed. The shalamim, or the peace offering, expresses gratitude because of his mercy and because of his goodness. The chatat, or the sin offering, demonstrates our sorrow over the error that we've committed. And the asham, or the guilt offering, acknowledges the guilt of the error. We say, yes, we are guilty. And so all of these things teach us different lessons. Specifics will come in just a moment here. But I want us to understand that these sacrifices do teach us things. In fact, in one regard, these offerings act as tutors and or teachers, and teachers prepare students for a test. In other words, we shouldn't take the position that these sacrifices are not for us in the sense that we have nothing to learn from them. Because number one, we are a royal priesthood. And so the priesthood was to be familiar with the sacrificial system, because the sacrificial system was to teach us about presenting ourselves as a living sacrifice. Of course, Paul writes to us in Romans chapter 12, verse 1 and 2, he says, I beseech you therefore, brethren, by the mercies of God, that you present your bodies a living sacrifice. So notice that it's by the mercies of God, because of that, that you present your bodies a living sacrifice, holy, that is, set apart, acceptable to God, that is to say, untainted and unpolluted, which is your reasonable service. As I understand that, or the way I would interpret that, that's the least you're to do. And do not be conformed to this world, but be transformed by the renewing of your mind, that you may prove what is that good and acceptable and perfect will of God. And the only way, apparently, that you're going to know what is good, what is acceptable, and what is the perfect will of God, is if you're willing to present your bodies a living sacrifice. We're going to learn and understand that blood symbolized the seed of life, because that's where the life of all flesh is. And so this is to express to us through the sacrificial system that man's soul was to be poured out before God. He doesn't require our blood. He doesn't want our blood. And again, mercifully, he allowed them to have a substitute sacrifice, which is going to, of course, point us to Yeshua. But the idea was, in bringing that sacrifice and appropriating what God had made available, was to be an expression of your willingness to pour out your very soul, everything that you are. The innards of the animals were burned, because that represented the need for us to purge everything from within us, not just the stuff that's on the outside that looks obvious, but in those internal places, those things that nobody else sees. The sacrifices, many of them were cut in pieces, suggesting that every piece of us should surrender to his will, and not just give him 90%, but give him 100%, every piece of us, physically, emotionally, spiritually. In short, what the sacrificial system is going to teach us is that God is the giver of life. And so consequently, man, those who follow him, those who are his people, should devote their lives to the life giver. And if we don't learn how to do this, and if we don't learn how complete this must be, and how total it must be, then we have to ask ourselves, will we be ready for the test that is surely coming? In other words, can we hope to be a people who overcome by the blood of the Lamb, by the word of their testimony, and who didn't love their lives even unto death, if we can't learn that the sacrificial system teaches us of how completely God expects us to be poured out before him? You know, we have the story in 1 Samuel in chapter 15, when Saul was supposed to wipe a group of people out and not take any kind of spoils of war, etc. And Samuel goes down and hears the bleeding of sheep in his ears, and Saul tries to justify it by saying, you know, I kept the best of the flock, so to speak, because I'm going to offer sacrifices unto the God of Israel. And of course, what did Samuel say? God wants your obedience, because your sacrifices don't mean anything if he doesn't have your obedience. In other words, you can go through the motions of offering sacrifice after sacrifice after sacrifice, but if God doesn't have your heart, then all those sacrifices are nothing. And so obedience, which is a manifestation of your heart, is better than sacrifice. Now, that being said, it is very consistent in Scripture that we have these animals being the agent of sacrifice. In Genesis chapter 3, after Adam sins, there's an offering. He would bring an offering, and of course, Abel continued this practice. He brings an offering of the firstlings of his flock and of their fat in Genesis 4. Of course, after Adam, and of course, Cain kills Abel, and then Seth, and then you have the succeeding generations, there's a lot of failure. People are profaning the name of the Lord in Genesis chapter 4. And then we have the flood. And then after the flood, Noah brings an offering. And then several generations later, you have Abraham. After even more human failure, Abraham is chosen, and he brings an offering. In other words, each time God revealed himself to man, after a period of failure on behalf of man, it initiated a new beginning, if I could put it that way. And every time there was a new beginning, there was an offering being brought. And so then when Israel comes out of Egypt and they go to Mount Sinai after failure on their part, it signifies a new era, a new beginning. And at that point, Israel experienced something that in many ways recalls what things were like during the days of Adam. And by that I mean God being in the midst of them. Adam would presumably go into the midst of the garden, and that's where God would at times come down and speak to Adam. And so when we see them in the wilderness, and especially when the Mishkan is brought forth, and we see Moses erecting the Mishkan, and then we have the Holy Presence descending into the Mishkan and being in their midst, that is to recall, to some degree anyway, what things were like when Adam was in the garden before he fell. And so what we see when the Mishkan is erected and the presence of God is there, offerings are brought. And so this is how things continued from the very beginning. After failure, there's a new beginning, there's offering. There's more failure, there's a new beginning, there's more offering, and so on and so on. And this is what we see in the wilderness, in the Mishkan, and that's how things continued until there was even more failure. And then there's another new beginning, and another offering was brought. But now we're talking about Messiah Yeshua, who is, according to Paul, the last Adam. And we see Yeshua coming as a bondservant, who makes it possible for his followers, for you and me, to be temples of the Holy Spirit, where his presence can dwell in us, just as he did in the Mishkan, just as he would in the garden in the very beginning. And even though we are temples of the Holy Spirit, nevertheless, we are waiting for the completion. That is, when we behold his glory, because we understand we're still walking around in houses of flesh. And when we see him, we're going to be like him, for we shall see him as he is. That's when mortal would put on immortality. And at that point, everything's going to come full circle. And we can, like presumably Adam did, we will be able to behold him face to face. And so as we kind of begin in the sacrificial system, we see that it's going to be about a matter of the heart. It's not a matter of how many sacrifices can you bring, how much they cost, how much blood can you spill. That's not the point. Unfortunately, that's all people see, or that's all many people can see. But in reality, what it's all about is it's exposing your heart. What's in your heart? And so as we begin, as in times past, we're not going to read all of the Torah portion. We will leave that to you. We are going to simply bring to your attention certain points within the portion about certain words and phrases and concepts. So in verse 1, here is where we get the name for Vayikra, because it says in Hebrew, Vayikra, and the Lord called. Now, the very first letter is Vav, and there Vav is used as the conjunction and. Because in English, when you use a conjunction like and, what are you doing? You're joining two phrases together. In other words, what comes before, you're joining it to what comes after. And so what we see here in this is that there is a close connection with the book of Vayikra and the book Shemot, or Exodus, because the last Torah portion ends by recording for us the completion of the sanctuary, the Mishkan. And the Mishkan was a culmination of God's desire to dwell in them, to dwell in his people. And so we see it was completed, and the word there in Hebrew is milah, when the Shekinah rested in the Mishkan. Now what it says is, it says, Ukvod Adonai milah ha-mishkan. The glory of the Lord filled the tabernacle. Filled. But filled, milah, is also, or also carries the idea of being completed. In other words, when Moses erects the tabernacle, he finished his work. Moses' work was dependent on Bezalel and Aholiab having finished their work. But Aholiab and Bezalel could not have done their work unless the people had brought the offerings. But the people couldn't have brought the offerings if they have not gone first to the Egyptians to get these things, the gold, the silver, the brass, etc., from the Egyptians. In other words, everything was dependent on what come before. Going to the Egyptians made it possible to bring the contributions in the wilderness, which made it possible for Bezalel and Aholiab to take those offerings and transform them into the furnishings and the utensils, etc. And then having done that, that made it possible for Moses to go and erect the tabernacle, to go and set it up. However, that's not the completion of it. The completion of it is when the Shekinah descended in the form of a cloud, something visible that the people could see, and his presence fills it up to the degree that Moses is afraid to go in, doesn't dare go in. But that he filled the tabernacle with his presence is also to be understood. He completed it. That was the whole point of the Mishkan, that he would be in their presence, that he would be in their midst. So this was to indicate that the revelation that they received at Mount Sinai was going to continue with them. Now, the psalmist writes in Psalm 68, verse 17, "The Lord is among them, as in Sinai, in the holy place." That's the way it reads in the New King James. But the word "as in" and "place" is in italics, which means that word is not there in the text. And so the way we would read it is this: "The Lord is among them, Sinai, in the holy place," or in the tabernacle. In other words, what happened at Sinai, God speaking to Moses from the mountain, was now going to be in the Mishkan. The revelation that they received from Sinai, the same revelation is going to come forth from the Mishkan, from the tabernacle, when God would speak to Moses from between the cherubim. And so then, that is when his presence fills the house, that is the completion of the Shekinah. And so all of this was to say, the end of Exodus is not our cue to forget about everything we just learned and to detach it from what we're going to read in Leviticus and then go to Leviticus and compartmentalize the book of Leviticus. No, what we see is that Vayikra is just a continuation of what we read at the end of Shemot. And so, as we open in Vayikra, we see that connection, and then we see that it describes the instructions concerning sacrifice and priestly duties. In other words, if his desire was that the Mishkan be there so that his presence could be in their midst, now in Vayikra what we see is he is telling them what to do to sustain that has been attained, and that is God's presence among them. Because you see, he is holy, he is set apart, and they, for him to remain in their presence, must approach him in holiness. They must walk before him upright. And so there is a certain manner, there's a certain protocol that they were to come before him so that he may remain in their presence. And so the way, at least in the wilderness and then later in the temple, that they were to maintain this holy set-apart status was the sacrificial system. Now, if you were to look in Hebrew at the word Vayikra, you'll see that it's Vav, Yud, Chuf, Resh, Aleph. And the Aleph of Vayikra is in miniature in the text. And the reason is because in ancient times, the Hebrew text was written in a continuous row. In other words, there weren't spaces between the words. If you look at a Tanakh or a Chumash today, you'll see the spaces in between the words so that it'll help us be able to pronounce the words in Hebrew. But in the older scrolls, this was not the case. All the words run together. So imagine how difficult that would be. Well, later on, somebody decides, you know what, we need to put some spaces in the words to make reading this easier. So when that would happen, occasionally you'd have words like Vayikra that ended with, in this case, an Aleph. And you have the next word, which in this case is El, that begins with an Aleph. And in the original text, that additional Aleph was not there. It was shared. So then, later on, when these spaces came and they wanted to write these words the way they should be pronounced, if there was an additional letter that had not originally been there, then it was written smaller. And in the case of Vayikra, that's what we see. And I only say that because a lot of times people will ask questions, well, how come they did this letter smaller and how come they put this there? Well, in that case anyway, in Vayikra, that's why the Aleph of Vayikra is so much smaller than the rest of the letters, because it wasn't originally in the text. And they wanted to make sure to take great care in the sacredness and the sanctity of the text to let people know, look, we put this Aleph there for clarity's sake, but it wasn't originally there. All right. Now, in verse 1, it says that God spoke to Moses from the tent of meeting, the Mishkan. Because, again, before the Mishkan was there, before God's presence was in the Mishkan, when Moses needed to hear from God, he was going to Sinai. And so the Mishkan now is, as we have already spoken of, is going to be where God speaks to them. This is where the revelation is going to come from. In verse 2, it says, when any man wants to bring an offering. What that is to say is, because it doesn't say when any Hebrew or when any Israelite, etc., but when any man wants to bring an offering, that would indicate to us that even heathens could bring a burnt offering if they were so inclined. God does not close the doors to those who are among the nations, who are compelled to come to the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. He never has, he never will. And so a man's faith, not his genealogical record, is what God considers. And so we could go off into a teaching here, which we won't, but just we do want to make mention of the fact that that's why it's so important for us to see that when we come to the Messiah and we are grafted into this good olive tree in Romans 11, that we are, if we are Messiahs, the seed of Abraham and heirs according to the promise, Galatians 3:29, which is to say that even though we weren't born ethnically Israeli, the God of Israel has never excluded those who weren't born ethnically Israeli. What the God of Israel has always been looking for is those who have a heart to come to Him and to offer themselves to Him. And so again, a man's faith and not his genealogy is what God considers. So it says, when any man. Now, a second thing that's interesting about that statement is that the word man is not what we would have expected it to be in Hebrew. In other words, you would expect the word there to be ish, but it's Adam, or we would say Adam. And so the question is, why does he say Adam instead of ish? And so the answer would be that obviously that God wanted to put us in mind of Adam, the original Adam. Now, interestingly enough, in the Haftarah for this particular Torah portion, which is portions of Isaiah 43 and Isaiah 44, in Isaiah 43, verse 27, it says this, "Your first father sinned." And that, I believe, as do others, refers to Adam. So in other words, your first father, Adam, sinned. And so what is being conveyed to us by the use of the word Adam instead of the word Ish? So to answer the question, we've got to go back and look at what Adam was there to do. In other words, Adam was placed in the garden, and what was he placed in the garden to do? He was there to work and to guard. That was his mission. And my opinion is that the garden functioned as the first earthly sanctuary. We have a teaching that goes into great detail of this. It's called Return to Eden. And so because of that, I won't go into all the details here. But what we see is in the beginning, we have a region, an area called Eden that I believe corresponds to the court. You have the garden that's placed in Eden. Consequently, it becomes the Garden of Eden. I suggest that corresponds to the holy place. And then within the garden itself, you have the midst of the garden. And I believe that that corresponds to the most holy place, the Holy of Holies. And of course, in the midst of the garden was where the tree of life was. And this is where God would come down in the breezy part of the day. And so if the garden functioned as the first earthly Mishkan, if you will, that would imply that Adam's role was a priest, if not the high priest, nonetheless a priest. Also consider that before the fall, Adam didn't eat by the sweat of his brow. That came afterwards. In other words, before the fall, food was present. God had told him, you may freely eat of all the trees of the garden, except, of course, the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. The point is, he wasn't out there toiling. He wasn't out there sweating, trying to bring forth his bread. It was readily available. So that being understood, then the question is, what was Adam's work? And if we have in the garden a picture of the first sanctuary with Adam functioning as a priest, then obviously his work is this, to minister to the Most High God. Now, jumping ahead to the Levitical priesthood, Aaron and his sons didn't plow, they didn't sow, and they didn't reap in order to eat. For the most part, where did their food come from? Well, their portions of the offerings. Because what were they supposed to be doing? They were supposed to be ministering unto God, representing the people to God and God to the people. That's what their work was. As a matter of fact, they were in their own Shabbat working. Because their work was to minister unto God. And so what I'm trying to say is that Adam, if he's a priest, then he was working as a priest, that is to walk holy. And not only to do the work of a priest, but to guard as a priest that was entrusted to him. The Levitical priesthood, Aaron and his sons, had to guard the sanctity of the sanctuary. They had to make sure that nothing that was a pollutant or anything that was defiled or profane would contaminate the sanctuary in any way. They had to work and they had to guard that work. And so it's interesting that in Genesis chapter 2, when it says about the man having to work and to guard, the term that's translated to work is la'avda, la'avda. And le'avda is synonymous with avoda, avoda, same root word. And avoda is the term that is given to the sacrificial service of the temple. In other words, the priesthood of the tabernacle and the temple were essentially doing the same thing or performing the same instruction that was given to Adam in the very beginning. Now, the root of both of these words, avoda and le'avda, is the word avad, which means, again, to work, but it's synonymous with the term eved. In fact, it's spelled exactly the same way. And the word eved means servant, or even better, bond servant. So in other words, what we see then is that Adam's work was to be a bond servant. And a bond servant was someone who had determined to serve their master not out of fear, but because they loved him. In fact, in Exodus chapter 21, verse 5, in regard to the bondservant or the eved, it says, "But if the servant or eved plainly says, 'I love my master, my wife, and my children, I will not go out free,' then he comes back to the master, he has his ear open, he's attached to the door of his house, literally and figuratively, and he goes into the house to serve his master, not for 6 more years, but forever. Meaning that he loves his master that much that he wants to serve him. He wants to give him his heart. He wants to give him his mind. He wants to give him his strength. And so as a consequence of loving his master in that regard, he no longer has to be concerned about his welfare. He doesn't have to be concerned about where his next meal is coming from or who's going to care for his children when they're sick or who's going to protect him when he's under attack from his enemy. Who's going to take care of that? His master is going to attend to those things. And so essentially what we see in the bond servant is that someone who has a heart to love their master that much, who wants to serve him forever and do whatever he asks them to do, is essentially going to receive the benefits of being a son. And in fact, that's what happens to the bond servant. He becomes a son. Now, this is to say that the use of the word Adam in Leviticus chapter 1 verse 2 is suggesting to us that Adam's mission in the garden was not to present an offering so much as it was to be an offering. In other words, he is the offering. If he's the priest, then he's offering himself as a bondservant. He's making himself to be the offering. And so when any Adam, in Leviticus 1:2, brings an offering, it is to be understood that he is offering himself. Again, this reminds us of Romans chapter 12, verse 1, that we are to present our bodies as a living sacrifice, holy and acceptable unto the Lord. But this also reminds us that Yeshua comes as a bondservant. And he, what does he do? He offers himself. Because that's what the bondservant does. He negates himself and he seeks to please God by offering God what he truly wants. And what does God truly want? He wants our heart. And so as a bondservant, he chooses to serve his master because he loves him. It is an expression that he wants to give his master his heart. And what's the first and great command? Love the Lord your God with all of your heart first, then your mind and soul, and then your strength. Because the person that loves his master, the Creator, with all of his heart, is going to follow all of his commandments because of this love. You see, when coming back to the sacrificial system, the animal was secondary. The animal is simply emblematic of what that worshiper feels. And in reality, what God was wanting and looking for and seeking was that a worshiper who would follow the protocol, so to speak, but it would be emblematic of what is in that man's heart. Because in Psalm 40, David writes for us in chapter 40, verse 6 through 8, it says that sacrifice and offering you did not desire. My ears you have opened. Burnt offering and sin offering you did not require. Then I said, behold, I come. In the scroll of the book it is written of me. I delight to do your will, O my God, and your law is within my heart. And so what we see there, folks, is David expressing that God didn't want sacrifice and offering, burnt offerings and sin offerings. It's not what he required. And if you'll notice, between those two statements, it says that my ears you have opened. Literally, my ears you have pierced, alluding to the rights of the bondservant when he comes to his master and says, I love you, I don't want to leave, I want to be your servant forever. His ear is open. He's literally and figuratively attached to the door of the house. And then he goes into the house to serve his master forever because his master is in his heart and he loves his master. And so notice it says, I delight to do your will, O my God, and your law, your instructions, is within my heart. These things are written on my heart. Of course, this is ultimately referring to Yeshua because it says, I come in the scroll of the book is written of me. No one can say that but the Messiah. All of that is to say, Yeshua comes as the last Adam to teach us what the first Adam was supposed to do. And that is to be a bondservant, to love the Lord your God with all of your heart, your mind, your soul, and your strength, and to pour yourself out completely, every piece of you, because you love your master. And the sacrifice that you are willing to become is exemplified in the sacrifice that the Creator mercifully substitutes for you. It's just in the case of the last Adam, no animal was substituted for him. He became the substitute for you and for me. So again, the reason he uses Adam over Ish is because it is to bring to mind what Adam was supposed to do and ultimately looking toward what the last Adam would do. Now, the offering that is first mentioned here is voluntary. And of course, that is distinct from the ones that will be described later because there are some mandatory offerings. But this one's voluntary. This one's if you, this is what I want to do. I feel like I should. In fact, the word that is used for offering is korban. Korban. Kuf resh bet nun. Korban. And korban means that which is brought near to God because that is the purpose of the offering. To get closer to God. To come into his presence. He's in ours. Now there are qualifications, there are instructions as far as approaching him, because that's how it is when you approach a king. And so the purpose of the korban is so that we may approach him, that we may be brought near to him. Again, indicating that this is all about wanting to see what's in our heart. Now it's interesting that in connection to the sacrifices, the name Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh is used exclusively. In other words, when it talks about these different sacrifices, no other title, like Elohim, for instance, is used, because Elohim is to denote strength, judgment, those types of things. And it's not, or at least in the text, it's not that God wants to see us bring sacrifices to a judgmental, strict disciplinarian, as much as it is coming to Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh, which grammatically speaking is in a feminine form. In other words, it's about us drawing close to him, to having a relationship, to having intimacy with him, to draw near to him. Because again, these sacrifices are not for God's benefit. They're not to satisfy a taste for blood or to satiate his anger. Actually, these sacrifices are for our benefit. Because God doesn't need our cattle, he doesn't need our flocks, he doesn't need our birds, our pigeons, and our turtle doves. Because as I said, as the psalmist says, He owns the cattle on a thousand hills. He doesn't need them. It's just that God made provision to us that he may continue to dwell among us. And the question then becomes, what are they willing to surrender, or what are you and I willing to surrender in order that we may draw near to him? God had made a sacrifice to be among them. Well, what sacrifice did he make? Well, let's just jump ahead to what it speaks of prophetically. The Lamb is slain from the foundation of the world. And so perhaps they didn't realize it, but God had already made a sacrifice. His heart, if I can put it that way, is exposed in that the Lamb is slain from the foundation of the world. It was his desire to be among them. So he's already made the sacrifice, and so now he wants to know, what sacrifice are you willing to make? Are you willing to pour out yourself the way I will be poured out? Are you willing to express that you love me more than you love yourself? Because for God so loved the world that he gave his only begotten Son, that whosoever should believe him should not perish but have everlasting life. Now, Korban, the word, comes from the verb karav. But if you look at the word Korban in Hebrew, again, it's Kuf Resh Bet Nun, there is a hint that this term for offering is inferring calling a son. Because the word Kara, Kuf Resh Aleph, Kara, is to call out. That's where we get Vayikra, by the way, because God called out to Moses. And then Ban, or the end of Korban, is Bet Nun, and Bet Nun alone is the word Ben or son. And so there is a hint within the term Korban that those who want to draw near to God, going back to the concept of the bondservant again, those who want to draw near to God are going to say, I don't want to go my own way, I want to do things your way. And the reason I want to do things your way is because I love you. And I don't want to go and be on my own. I want to come into your house. And so he goes to the door and has his ear open. And again, that really is indicating that he becomes part of his master's house forever, that he is going to reap the rewards of being a son. He is going to be a son. And so Korban, this voluntary offering that is given to show our desire to draw near to him, is also hinting at our being called to be a son, because who are the sons of God? Those who are led by the Spirit of God. And John records for us that as many as received him, that is the Messiah, he gave them the power, that is the right, the ability to become the sons of God. So Korban, hinting at calling a son, is a voluntary offering and is the medium by which man can attain this nearness to God, that is, son to father. Now, the text tells us that the korban, or the offering, must come from the herd or the flock, meaning that these were domestic animals. They were not going to be wild animals. Because, number one, domestic animals don't go and prey on other creatures. They don't live by killing others. And besides that, wild animals don't cost anything. So these are domestic animals only. Wild animals are excluded. And I would suggest that it's similar to the idea that in the building of the sanctuary, you know that no iron tool was used, because the iron tool is symbolic of the sword. And so it was to suggest that the building of God's house would not be through violence. The reason David was not permitted to build the temple is because he was a man of blood. And so likewise, the animals that are used in the sacrificial system are not to be associated with violence. That is, wild animals that would go and prey on others, that would live by killing. And there's a footnote to this as well. Tubal Cain, who was a descendant of Cain, who was of the wicked one, according to 1 John 3, in Genesis chapter 4, Tubal Cain is the first artificer of things made with bronze and iron. And the tradition has long been that those things that he made from iron and bronze as weapons. So that would hint to me that in God's house, Cain and what Cain represents, and that he is a rebel, is not welcome. You see, Cain, when being told that if you'll do the right thing, Cain, won't I accept your sacrifice, but instead of going and doing the right thing, because he would have known to do the right thing, just as Abel would have known to do the right thing, Cain nevertheless goes out, calls his brother into the field, and murders him. Violence. Now, in verse 3 of chapter 1, it begins the discussion about the olah, the burnt offering. And the olah is that which ascends. That which ascends. And some people say that talks about the fact that everything was burned on the altar and the smoke is ascending up to God, etc. But at any rate, olah is something that ascends. And the olah, or the burnt offering, was to be emblematic of complete submission to God, because the entire animal is burnt on the altar. Everything except the skin, except the hide. And this is the oldest and the most common type of sacrifice that we see in the scripture. And again, this burnt offering could be brought by an Israelite or a heathen. Any man could bring this if he felt so compelled. If a person felt estranged from God, felt like, you know, I haven't been living the way I should, I haven't been doing what I should, that person could voluntarily bring his sacrifice. Because again, a lot of people will look at these sacrifices and the rituals associated with them and say, oh, that's law, that's blood and guts, that's legalism, that's this, that's that. But in the burnt offering, what we see is if a person realized, you know, I have not been living the way I should live, he could voluntarily bring his sacrifice. And again, his sacrifice is a desire to draw near to God and is emblematic of wanting to pour himself out. But God in his mercy doesn't require our blood on the altar. He allows an animal to substitute for us. But now, when a person realizes that they are estranged from God and wants to bring this burnt offering, we have to understand that communion with God is impossible if there is sin. He's holy, and he's not going to mix and mingle with sin. And so there is this redemptive quality, if I can say it that way, this quality about the burnt offering that deals with the sin issue. Now, the term olah is related to the word aliyah, or one who ascends. And I know that most of you have heard of the term aliyah. When people want to immigrate to Israel, they're going to make aliyah. And what that really means is they're going to go up. You're going to go up to Jerusalem. You're going to ascend. And so this is all tied to the idea of the ascending the hill of the Lord. Who is going to ascend the hill of the Lord? And who will stand in his holy place? Well, the psalmist tells us that it's the one who has clean hands, that is literally clean palms, and a pure heart. And what's so interesting about the word pure in this particular example is that it's the word bar, spelled bet resh, bar, which is also the word used in bar mitzvah, for instance. And bar mitzvah means son of the command. Bar, in other words, not only means pure, but it means son. And so who will go up? Who is it that's going to ascend? Who's going to aliyah? Who's going to olah? The one who has clean hands. Their sin has been dealt with. And now they're going to stand there because they have a pure heart. Or shall we say, the heart of a son, which is going to take us back to the whole concept of the korban. In other words, the olah is exemplifying those who are ready and willing to totally submit themselves to God. Those who have the heart of a son. And if they have the heart of the son, that means they have the heart of a bond servant. They are offering themselves as a living sacrifice, holy and acceptable unto God. The fact that the feet are consumed on the altar is emblematic of the fact that, you know, our hands have been used to commit sinful acts. Our feet have run to commit sinful acts. And so every piece of us, every part of us, has to be consumed if we're going to totally submit ourselves to God and to his purposes. And so again, the olah is something that ascends, related to the idea of ascending the hill of the Lord. And again, who is going to ascend the hill of the Lord? Or who shall stand in his holy place? The one who has clean palms, the one who has the heart of a son. And in the context of the Mishkan, or in the temple later on, who literally stood in his holy place? It was the priests. It was those who had been set apart and sanctified. So again, all of this, ladies and gentlemen, is to indicate to us that the olah, the burnt offering, is to express that someone voluntarily, not because they're made to do it, but because they want to do it. Just like the bondservant could have gone his own way after being released, but of his own free will, because he wants to. He voluntarily brings himself to his master's house and submits to his master, becoming his servant, read into that, his son, forever. Now, these sacrifices, as we said earlier, could be taken from the herd, or domestic animals, I should say, but it could be taken from the herd, it could be taken from the flock, or it could come from fowls. And what that indicates to me is that God doesn't look to the cost. In other words, the bull is going to cost more than the goat, but the goat's going to cost more than the turtle dove. But God doesn't look to the cost, but he looks to the spirit in which it's offered. Or he looks into the heart. He wants to know what's in that heart. Yet, the fact that it could be from the herd or from the flock or from the fowls does acknowledge that there are those who have more and there are those who have less. And so God, being just, he prescribes offerings that are going to accommodate those with less. But those with more, who would be tempted to give as those who have less, what does that say of them? In other words, if someone who could afford to bring a bull decides that I'm going to offer a dove, what is that revealing about that person? Because technically speaking, the dove meets the criteria. But what does it reveal about that person's heart? And so, consequently, from God's point of view, their offering, in other words, if they could afford the bull, but decide, you know what, I'm just going to offer the dove, that's going to disqualify their offering, not because of the cost, but because of the intent of the heart. And once again, everything is going to bring us back to that. It's about the matter of the heart. What's in the heart? And again, you know, a lot of people have chosen to look at the nuts and bolts of the sacrificial system, the blood, the ritual, and that's all they see. But what we're trying to see is God is looking into the heart of man. That's what's most important to him, and that's what we need to glean from this, and that's why it is a tutor to us. It teaches us that in our lives, if we follow his commands because we want to be seen of people as following his commands, we can have tzitzit to our ankles and beard to drag the floor, and we could say the names correct, and we can have the Shabbat, the time to light the candles, and all these different things worked out to a T, and yet if our heart hasn't changed, then all that's for nothing. It means nothing to God if it has not changed our heart, because all of those things should be merely an expression of what's in our heart. Now, the person would bring an offering, of course, and this offering must be without blemish, because anything less than that is unacceptable. And once again, Romans 12 speaks to this, that we are to be holy and acceptable, again, which is our reasonable service. I want you to also notice this, that the person was to bring this, and he doesn't just hand it off to the priest and leave and not be concerned with it. No, he's going to bring it to the sanctuary, and he's going to participate in the slaughter of this animal. And he brings it to the entrance of the sanctuary, and he's inside the court. He's not outside. He's inside the court, and he brings it to the entrance of the sanctuary. And notice in this particular point of the command, what it does is to centralize unity of worship. It attains unity of worship in that the people are not authorized to themselves determine where I'm going to present the gift or how I'm going to present the gift. There is protocol. There are parameters. And so again, it centralizes worship. It attains unity of worship because the people are not left to their whims and what's convenient for them. There is a protocol. Now, even the Greek philosopher Plato saw the danger of the lack of unity in worship. Now, of course, it's within the context of idol worship. But if an idol worshiper can see the danger in the lack of unity in worship, how much more so should we as the people of God? In other words, what Plato was fearful of is that if you have this lack of unity, that it's going to result in all these different private temples being built with every superstition known to man running rampant. And that's what a Greek philosopher who is not a follower of the God of Israel saw. So that's very interesting to us because, again, God directs them to bring them to a particular place. There's a particular protocol, and it centralizes the way things are to be done. It gets at the heart of unity, etc. This is something so important that it cannot be left to the discretion of an individual to decide where, how, etc. In other words, no pastor, no rabbi, no evangelist, no scribe, no individual is authorized to say, well, I think we're going to worship God this way, or let's do it this way, or let's do it that way. There is a protocol. There is a unity of worship that's prescribed here that says, if you're going to do it my way. And that is one of the points made, by the way, by James or Yaakov in Acts chapter 15, when we've got all of these non-Jews coming into the faith. Some people are sneaking in and tell them that you've got to be circumcised after the manner of Moses to be saved. This is causing an uproar. Paul's there, Peter's there, etc., in this big council in Jerusalem. And so James sends a letter out saying to these non-Jews that they should abstain from the pollution of idols. And there's other things that he says, but that one in particular, that they were to abstain from the pollution of idols, a lot of people will look at that and say, well, I don't worship an idol. Well, what that really is getting at is this, that in the book of Leviticus, we will see later in a later Torah portion, that if someone decides they want to set up an altar over there or over here or set up a temple over there, and then they want to offer their burnt offerings to the Lord there in a place that he didn't prescribe, in a manner he didn't prescribe, that God would see it as being offered unto idols. And so this unity of worship that is alluded to here in Leviticus chapter 1 is a point that's going to come up later for believers in the Messiah. In other words, once again, do things God's way. Because you're talking in Acts 15 about people who come from all these different heathen lands and who where everything goes, anything goes. And so they're trying to say, no, we're going to have to establish some parameters here. Now, the reason it's important to do it God's way is that he, that is the offerer, the worshiper, who's bringing the offering, may be accepted before the Lord. In other words, do it the right way so that your offering may be received by the Lord. If you're going to do it the right way. Which again reminds us of what God spoke to Cain after Cain's offering was rejected in Genesis chapter 4, verse 6 and 7. So the Lord said to Cain, why are you angry? And why has your countenance fallen? If you do well, will you not be accepted? And if you do not do well, sin lies at the door, and its desire is for you, but you should rule over it. Again, do it the right way. I've told you how to do it. And so, is it in your heart? Do you care for me enough that you'll do things the way I ask you to do them? Or are you going to just pay me lip service and go through the motion, but then you're going to do it your way? Because if that's your heart, then what you're offering that you say is being offered to me, I will view it as being offered unto idols. Thus, the abstention from the pollution of idols. Do it God's way. Now, in verse 4, this person was to lay his hand on the sacrifice. The word in Hebrew is samach, and samach means to lean, really. He was to take his hands and to literally lean on this animal, on the head of this animal. The word samach is also associated with taking hold of something. It's also indicating to support something. But in this context, what it was really getting at is that It's indicating that the animal was substituting for the one who was offering the animal. It's the one who's replacing him. Because from samach we get smicha. And smicha is the Hebrew word for ordination. And the example of this we have is in Numbers 27, verse 23, when Moses goes and he places his hands on Yehoshua. Why? To signify that Yehoshua was going to be replacing or substituting for Moses. And so he ordains him. He leans on him. And so when the person was to bring the offering, they would lay his hand, samach, they would lean on him, and indicating that this animal is replacing me. This is an expression that this is me, but you don't require my blood, and so you are graciously and mercifully allowed this animal to substitute for me, but I am going to lean on him, I'm going to place my hands upon him. And of course, the tradition is that during this time that the person is putting his hands on the animal, he's not just sitting there, but he's professing and confessing his sins and his errors and his transgressions, and he's praying and he's appealing to the Almighty. Because, again, all this is about the heart. And so without this person being willing to profess their error and their transgression and the fact that I have been estranged from you and I am the one who walked away, it was pointless to bring the offering. There wasn't any point in bringing the offering if you weren't willing to pour out your heart. Because in Proverbs 15, verse 8, we're told that the sacrifice of the wicked is an abomination to the Lord, but the prayer of the upright is his delight. Now, this was to make atonement for him. And the term in Hebrew is kafer. Kafer, and that means to cover. But it's also the word that means to purge, and it's a word that's used in certain cases to indicate restoration. In English, it means to atone. And that word is, kafir is related to Kippur, where we get Yom Kippur, but the whole idea of atoning. And so you cover the sin is purged, and there's restoration. There is atonement. And that word, again, in English, atone, originally meant to be set at one, or to be at one meant, if you will. Of course, now it has the idea of making amends. But the whole idea was that it would make atonement for him, is going to cover his sin, because he's wanting to purge that from him. And so consequently, there is restoration with his Creator. Now, verse 5, he shall kill. That is not the priest. Because a lot of people have had in mind that when these people would bring their animals, they would hand them off to the priest and the priest would do all the slaughtering. And the reality is that's not the case. The person that's bringing the offering is doing the killing. In fact, the word that's translated kill is shechat. And shechat literally means to slaughter. And by the way, from shechat we get the word shechita. And that doesn't mean just to put to death. And it doesn't just mean slaughter as in a butcher, but it means to slaughter in a swift, painless way so that you get the maximum effusion of blood. And so from this point, folks, this is where we get the idea of properly koshering an animal. Because you see, God is being merciful in that he's allowing this animal to substitute for the transgressor. But the animal is innocent. And so if it's going to be permitted that this animal substitute on our behalf, at the very least, this animal must be slaughtered in a painless way, that he would immediately lose unconsciousness, that he would immediately lose consciousness and not suffer. Now, after the person bringing the animal has done this, then the blood is received by the priest. And here's where the priest steps in. He receives the blood in the vessel, and then he takes it to the altar. Because the blood, of course, is where the life is. And the life, so to speak, is given back to God, who is the life giver. And again, this should not be understood to say that God is bloodthirsty. It should be understood to say that, according to Leviticus 17:11, blood being the carrier of life, it is sacred. And so it, if it's going to be spilled, it should only be reserved for sacred purposes. And so that blood that was on the altar was for the benefit of the worshiper, not for the gratification of God. Because again, Leviticus 17:11 says, "For the life of the flesh is in the blood, and I have given it to you upon the altar to make atonement for your souls, for it is the blood that makes atonement for the soul." So again, that is to say that the blood that was dashed against the altar was not for God's benefit, but God had given that to us upon the altar to make atonement for us. It's for our benefit. Now, in verse 6, this person, the person bringing the offering, it says he shall flay. That is to say, he removed the hide, the skins, because it was not part of the burnt offering. It was not part of the olah. In fact, when you took the burnt offering and you removed the hide was divided among the priests. And that to me is very interesting, because Messiah being completely poured out, you remember that they stripped him naked. And what did they do? Those who were attending to his sacrifice, they divided his garments. In fact, they cast lots for his garments. So I just find that to be quite interesting. This burnt offering, this animal, is going to be cut into pieces, but its limbs are not going to be broken. Now, the Messiah was beaten. He was scourged. All kinds of things. He was pierced, but none of his bones were broken. Now, after that person has cut the animal into pieces, the pieces are then to be placed upon the altar. The priests are to do this. They would situate it on the altar, the different pieces, and they would put wood upon the fire, etc. And so the reason it's cut into pieces, at least in part, is that when they arrange the pieces on the altar, the flames of the altar are going to pass between the pieces. And that is symbolizing the covenant is established between God and the person offering that animal. But that picture is also going to bring to mind what occurs in Genesis chapter 15, verse 10, when Abraham and God are coming into covenant with one another. Abraham slaughters the animals, he cuts them into pieces, he arranges the pieces, and you remember that the fire passed between the pieces. So we see this continuity in the tabernacle and even later on in the temple when the people would cut the offerings into pieces. The pieces are laid upon the altar and the flames of the altar come and pass between the pieces. Now, in the garden, the olah was likely the result of Adam's sin. In other words, what I'm getting at is when Adam sinned, you'll recall that he's naked, he's made aprons of these fig leaves to try to hide from God, and God ended up making them coats of skin to cover their nakedness, or to cover their shame. And so the implication is, if he made them coats of skin, then there had to be an animal that gave up that hide or those skins so that Adam could be clothed. And the implication is that that animal probably was burned upon an altar as a burnt offering, as an olah. And, of course, there's going to be purging, there's going to be restoration, there's going to be all those things conveyed to us. But the skins would be given to the priest. It would seem that the priest, in this case, who's God, is giving those skins back to man and using them to cover him. And so back to the olah and the mishkan, the skin of the offering had to be removed, because it reveals the naked condition of those who are willing to come close to God, to draw near to Him, to offer this burnt offering. In other words, they're just opening themselves up to God. They're revealing their naked situation. They're revealing their shame in their transgression, etc. All these things are conveyed through all of this. Now, in verse 14, of course, as we said earlier, they could bring an offering of the herd or of the flock or of fowl. They could bring turtle doves, because the turtle doves were considered to be the poor man's offering. Now, A dove is one of the most inoffensive of birds. In fact, I understand that if it is attacked, it will not retaliate. Now, the rabbis say the reason for this is because the dove is a symbol of Israel, inferring that Israel was going to have to suffer, is going to be attacked, and doesn't retaliate because God is our defender. Now, I find this very interesting because Yeshua says to us in Matthew chapter 5, "Blessed are those who are persecuted for righteousness' sake, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Blessed are you when they revile and persecute you and say all kinds of evil against you falsely for my sake. Rejoice and be exceedingly glad, for great is your reward in heaven, for so they persecuted the prophets who were before you." In other words, perhaps there is some strain of truth to this, that Israel is represented by this dove. But if so, then we have to conclude that ultimately the dove is emblematic of the Messiah himself, because he was as a lamb taken to slaughter, but he didn't open his mouth. They attacked him, but he didn't retaliate. In fact, they coaxed him. They taunted him to try to do something, and he still wouldn't say anything. In fact, he tells Peter, "Don't you know that I could call on my Father right now and tens of thousands of angels would be here right then?" But he doesn't do that. And so ultimately, he is emblematic of this stuff, which, by the way, even though its head is removed and the blood is poured out on the altar, interestingly, it's not rent in two like all the other sacrifices. Now, in chapter 2, it talks about predominantly the meal offering. It says, verse 1, when anyone, doesn't say when any man, but it says when anyone, and that word that is translated anyone is nephesh. And literally, nephesh means soul. So in other words, what it's saying was when any soul brings this offering. And the offering that he's talking about is the meal offering, because it's assumed that only the poorest of people, the poorest of the poor, would bring a meal offering instead of an animal or even a dove. Because if you consider that this would be the poorest among them, what is going to be the focus of the most poor among us? I believe, temporally speaking, they're going to have one goal, and that is feed my family. And so, in other words, this offering of the meal offering is emblematic of that that is most precious to them, temporally speaking anyway, and that is food. Because the poorest of the poor, that's about all they can do. They maybe can have just enough food to feed them for that day. And so, again, this offering is going to represent what would be most important to that person, that nephesh, that soul. So it is believed that because this person is the poorest, and this is all that he can afford to bring, he is bringing something that is representative of what is most important to him. And so God views that this person who's willing to bring this, it's as if he offered his nephesh, his very soul. And so that's interesting, because you recall in the scriptures that when Yeshua and his disciples are in the temple one day and people are bringing their offerings there, that the widow puts the mite in there. And Yeshua says of her, "Look, that woman, what she gave more than all of these other people, because she gave all that she had." He was implying that she gave of her heart, not of her means. Now, the meal offering in Hebrew is the word mincha, mincha. And typically, mincha does not involve the slaughter of an animal. Again, it's a fruit of the ground offering. It is a meal offering. But just because it doesn't involve the slaughter of an animal doesn't mean that it's less important. Because again, it is assuming that this is coming from the poorest of the poor. It is what is most important to them. He's offering his soul, so to speak. And the two main ingredients that we see in the meal offering is flour and oil. Of course, these were common food articles then. But notice they're not natural products. In other words, you don't go out into the field and see a field of flour. You see a field of wheat, but you don't see a field of flour. You don't go to an olive tree and find jars of oil hanging off the limbs. No, you find olives. In other words, they're not natural products, but they come as a result of work, of labor, of toil. And so this offering was to typify the consecration of man's work, his labor, and his toil to the service of God. This is the type of offering that Cain offered, but it was rejected. But Abel also brought of the firstlings of his flock, and interestingly in Hebrew, and it says, and his mincha was accepted. In other words, Cain brought a mincha, and it was rejected. Abel brought a mincha, and it was accepted, but it's because Abel also brought, not instead brought, but also brought of the firstlings of his flock and of their fat, indicating that God's acceptance or rejection wasn't based on the gift per se. It was based on the condition of the person who was offering it and their heart and the spirit in which it was given. And again, he reminded Cain, you know what's right. Why don't you do what's right? But what did Cain do? He exposed what was in his heart when he offered the gift in the first place by going out and murdering his brother. Now, in verse 2 of chapter 2, we see that it talks about the memorial part thereof is going to be placed on the altar. It's going to be a smoke, because there was only a portion of this that was actually placed on the altar. And the Hebrew term denotes that it was the best and the finest portion. And then some of it was going to be given to the priest. But the best and the finest of it was going to be burned up on the altar. Now in verse 4, it talks about unleavened loaves mixed with oil. And then it talks about unleavened wafers that were smeared with oil. And I found this very interesting, because rabbinical sources say that when these wafers, these unleavened wafers, were brought as a sacrifice, that the priest would smear it with oil in the form of the Greek letter chi, or, if you will, an X, or let's put it this way, a cross. They would smear it in the form of the X or the cross, or of course what we see in that, is because this is alluding to what Yeshua was going to do. In fact, in verse 6, these cakes and these wafers would be broken into pieces. They were broken to replicate the dissecting of the animal of the burnt offering. It had to be cut into pieces, right? And so these cakes or these wafers also were broken. And because this worshiper is even the poorest or going to be doing the same thing in principle that everybody else is doing, even though they can't afford what the others afford. But again, because it's a matter of the heart, the Creator's wanting to see what's in their heart. And so many things that could kind of spin off of that, but one thing we do see, that they're unleavened, that is matzah, if I can put it that way. They're broken. Of course, Yeshua talks about the matzah at Pesach is broken, because it represents his body being broken. If the tradition of it being smeared in the letter he or X, if you will, it's further indicating that there's this relationship between what is being brought broken and the Messiah's being poured out, the Messiah being broken on our behalf. And because the worshiper does this because he wants to be brought near to the Lord, suggests to me that Yeshua is no respecter of persons. He doesn't want just the rich man. He wants the poorest of the poor. Because for God so loved the world. Now, in verse 11, we see that no meal offering could be brought to the Lord if it contained chametz, or leaven. Because chametz, leaven, is a symbol of fermentation and corruption. Something that is corrupt is not going to be used for holy purposes. Now, sin becomes to be viewed as moral fermentation. Paul talks about the fact, and I'm just paraphrasing, that we got to purge the old leaven. We've got to get all that moral fermentation out of our lives. In pagan cults, honey was considered to be a favorite food of the gods, because it also talks about in these passages here that chametz or leaven was not to be burned on the altar, neither was honey. And rabbinical sources indicate the prohibition for honey is because, again, it was considered in pagan cults to be the favorite food of the gods. And so one belief is that this prohibition where honey is concerned was to free Israel from the thinking that sacrifices were food to God. However, there is reason to believe that the word devash, translated here as honey, is intended to be fruit, because there are fruits that have honey-like sweetness to them, and they're going to putrefy, you know, they're going to rot, etc. Because actually, it's my understanding anyway, honey doesn't. Honey, you know, you can store honey for a long, 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 long time, and so it doesn't corrupt and ferment. But if you take certain fruits, obviously, that's exactly what's going to happen. So there is some textual evidence to suggest that the vash here is not to mean honey like the honey from a bee, but it might be honey in the sense of it related to fruit. However, whatever it is, at any rate, they both, that is, leaven and honey, could be offered as first fruits, but they could not be offered on the altar as sacrifice. Now, compare that to verse 13. Because in verse 13, we see that salt was to be used, not with just the meal offerings, but actually to be used with every offering. No leaven, no devash, whether that's honey, or as some Jewish sources say, first fruits. Nevertheless, honey and leaven could not be used with any that were going to be placed on the altar. Salt was to be used in every one of them. And here's one of the things we see in that. Salt prevents what the leaven and the devash will do. Leaven produces fermentation and putrefaction. Salt prevents it. And so it's a preservative. And so the function of salt is to preserve what is being offered to God. Now, Yeshua says in Matthew 5, you, speaking of his people, Israel, you are the salt of the earth. You're the one that's supposed to preserve. You're supposed to preserve what's being offered to God. You're to preserve what's been given you. But if the salt loses its flavor, how shall it be seasoned? It is then good for nothing but to be thrown out and trampled underfoot by men. In other words, if salt is to be offered with all of the sacrifices brought to the altar, and that salt is seen as preservative, and we are called the preservative of the earth, then what is our purpose? If the salt can't serve its purpose, what good is it? And so if we're the salt, what is our purpose? And that is to preserve. In other words, to work and to guard what has been entrusted to us. Remember what Adam was to do? To work, to guard, to be ministers to the Most High, to walk upright before Him and to guard what He's entrusted to us. In other words, to propagate the covenant, to preserve it. See, in ancient times, salt was a sign of friendship, a sign of covenant. In fact, we read in Numbers 18 that salt is a preservative and is a symbol of an everlasting covenant. And so consequently, the salt was to be offered with all of the offerings, including the animals. Now, all of that is important for this reason. Our dinner tables, a table, in Hebrew, shulchan, is considered to be like an altar. And so because of that relationship, at least in the Hebrew world, we have the custom of when we sit down before the grace, before meals, we will take bread and we will dip the bread in salt. We will take the lechem, which in ancient times not only meant bread in the way you and I understand that to mean, but bread in the sense of flesh. And so, duplicating what happened in the Mishkan, they'll take the bread, they'll dip it in salt before they say the grace before meals, because the table is viewed as being an altar. And so considering the sacredness of the table in that culture anyway, and I think we would do well to revisit that in our culture. But nevertheless, considering the sacredness of the table, look at what Acts 15 has to say. Again, non-Jews are coming into the faith. They are coming in from all different backgrounds, not being raised according to the Torah and the parameters of the culture that gives us the Torah. And now we've got situations where people are telling them, you have to do this, you have to do that in order to be saved. There's a big ruckus. And so essentially the letter that goes out to them is wanting to establish table fellowship with them. Again, Shulchan is symbolizing the altar. And of course, in the Mishkan, the altar was not to be defiled with anything that is unclean. And so there couldn't be, according to Acts 15, any pollution of idols. We've already addressed that. There could be no fornication. There could be nothing strangled, and there could be no blood. And of course, those two right there speak of dietary laws. Those speak of what we're eating, how has it been prepared, we can't have any blood, etc. Because again, they're wanting to establish table fellowship. Keeping in mind that the offerings were to be brought to the door of the tent. That's where God established the place to be. In other words, you can't have this idea that you can do things your way and bring all your different thoughts and ideologies from your former life into this. No, there is a protocol. There is a prescribed method to do it. Abstention from the pollution of idols. We've got to have table fellowship. That's one thing you got to understand. Their hearts had to be repentant and dedicated to the one God, not to multiple gods. So there can't be any of this spiritual harlotry, this fornication, whether that's manifest spiritually or physically. Nevertheless, if we're going to have table fellowship, when we come to the altar, so to speak, you have to be purged of all that. There had to be clean offerings, things that had been slaughtered the proper way. That goes to strangled. And of course, blood was something sacred given for the atonement of the soul, and so consequently could not be in any meat that's going to be devoured. Once again, in this concept that the table and the altar are synonymous is giving us insight into some of the reason anyway that Yaakov and James, or James, and the council at Jerusalem sends out this letter to all of these non-Jews who are coming into the faith. Now, chapter 3 deals with the shalamim, which is known as the peace offerings, also called thank offerings, because the shalamim was given in gratitude, or given as a tribute to God for his goodness, because this person wants to be at peace with the Creator. Now, the Hebrew term is literally the slaughter peace offering. In many cases, it's rendered as feast peace offering. Because unlike the burnt offering, where everything is consumed, only a portion of the shalamim is going to be burnt on the altar. The rest, except for what was given to the priests, is going to be eaten by the worshiper, by his family, and by guests. Because that portion that they're going to partake of is going to be part of a solemn meal, which is following the sacrifice. Now, we read this in some other passages. But here's why that's interesting to me, because I can't read about a peace offering where some is offered, some's given to the priest, but the better part of it is given back to the worshiper, where he and his family and friends are going to eat a solemn meal after this sacrifice so that they can be at peace with the Creator. So interesting to me, because in Ephesians chapter 2 verse 11, Paul writes and says, therefore remember that you once Gentiles in the flesh, who are called uncircumcision by what is called the circumcision made in the flesh by hands, that at that time you were without Messiah, being aliens from the commonwealth of Israel and strangers from the covenants of promise, having no hope and without God in the world. But now in Messiah Yeshua, you who were once far off have been brought near by the blood of Messiah. For he himself is our peace, who has made both one and has broken down the middle wall of separation, having abolished in his flesh the enmity, that is, the law of commandments contained in ordinances, so as to create in himself one new man from the two, thus making peace, and that he might reconcile them both to God in one body through the cross, thereby putting to death the enmity. And he came and preached peace to you who were afar off and to those who were near. In other words, what I'm seeing in this is that this peace offering, at the very least, hints at the peace that the Messiah accomplished on our behalf. Probably first and foremost, to be at peace with the Creator, which was the emphasis of the peace offering. But we are told that there are two commands upon which all the Torah and the prophets hang. And that is, you shall love the Lord your God with all your heart, mind, soul, and strength. And so again, Yeshua comes to make peace that he might reconcile them both to God in one body. But the other, Yeshua says, that is like unto the first, is love your neighbor as yourself. On these two points hang, that does not mean gets rid of, but all the other things written in the Torah and the prophets are going to hang, that is, be supported by these two things, to love the Lord your God, to love your neighbor as yourself. When Yeshua comes to make peace, it's not just to reconcile man to God, but it's also to reconcile man to man. In this particular case, specifically speaking, uncircumcision and circumcision. In other contexts, natural branch, wild branch. To me, he is being symbolized through the peace offering, because how does he break down the middle wall of separation? By the cross, by going to the tree, and then being broken, being poured out. And so after the sacrifice, what does he say to do? He says, in the context of Passover, do this in remembrance of me. If I can put it this way, you're going to eat a solemn meal from here on out after the sacrifice has been made. And when you eat that solemn meal, understand that you're doing it in remembrance of me. And remembering his sacrifice is to put in mind that he is the one who broke down the middle wall of separation. He's made it possible for both uncircumcision and circumcision to be reconciled, to become one body, and that as that one body can then be reconciled to the Creator. Now in verse 2, the blood of this sacrifice was dashed against the altar in the event that the worshiper had done anything to render him unworthy to partake of the sacrificial meal. In other words, the blood was given as an atonement and as a rite of purification so that that person wouldn't be disqualified from partaking of the sacrificial meal that is going to come about after the sacrifice. So what that reminds me of is Paul's admonition of not eating of the Pesach unworthily. 1 Corinthians 11, verse 26, he says, "For as often as you eat this bread and drink this cup, you proclaim the Lord's death till he comes. Therefore, whoever eats this bread or drinks this cup of the Lord in an unworthy manner will be guilty of the body and the blood of the Lord." In other words, I read into that, going back to what we just read in the peace offering, that if the blood hasn't been applied, if the blood has not been applied as an atonement, then you are really being disqualified from partaking of this solemn meal. "But let a man examine himself, and so let him eat of the bread and drink of the cup. For he who eats and drinks in an unworthy manner eats and drinks judgment to himself, not discerning the Lord's body. For this reason many are sick and weak among you, and many sleep. For if we would judge ourselves, we would not be judged." In other words, let's make sure that there is nothing that would disqualify us from partaking of this meal in any transgression, but let's be restored and let's be purged of these things so that we may partake of these things worthily. Now, in verse 11, it mentions the food of the peace offering. And the word food there in verse 11 of chapter 3 is actually the word lechem. And of course, lechem is the word that is typically used for bread. And that's what it is literally, bread. But there was a primitive meaning of lechem that alluded to flesh. And in regard to the peace offering, it's talking about the food of the peace offering, or the lechem of the peace offering, which is again bread, but is also understood to mean flesh. It's interesting that the matzah we partake of in the solemn meal called Pesach is actually representing his body, his flesh. Now in verse 17 of chapter 3, we are told that we, as well as the blood, are not to partake of the fat. Now we all know why the blood is not to be eaten, because blood is given as an atonement for your souls upon the altar. It's sacred and to be used for sacred purposes. That's obvious, and that goes all the way back to the beginning. But this prohibition against fat, and I'm going to offer an opinion, is perhaps because it's in the fat of the animal where all the toxins are stored. Now, I'm going to tell myself here, but and I don't do this very often anymore. I don't eat a lot of steak and red meat. I do occasionally, but not a whole lot. But when I used to eat a lot of it, my very, very favorite steak was the one that had just a little bit of fat on the edge, because it gave it all that flavor. Here's my point. The thing that I liked as far as the flavor the most is the very thing that contained all the toxins. So what's the picture here? He doesn't want us to eat something that, even though it looks good, contains poison. Going all the way back to the beginning, you know, the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. Now, there are some that argue that it's only in particular cases that there's a prohibition against fat. Maybe, maybe not. But my point is I understand it. The fat is where the toxins are stored. And so that says plain and simply to me, God doesn't want us to consume the toxins. No more than he wants us to consume something that is set aside for sacred purpose. Now in chapter 4, it comes to the chatat, or the sin offering. And as we get into chapter 4, we're dealing now with certain offerings that were mandatory. Verse 1, notice that it is to address a sin that is committed through error, not intentional sin. Because these regulations didn't apply when the sin was intentional. Because apparently, these animal sacrifices were insufficient if the sin was intentional. And thus the question would be, what would atone for intentional sin? In other words, David, he sins with Bathsheba, he commits adultery with her, then to cover his tracks, he has Uriah the Hittite killed, and he thought these things through before he did them. Intentional sin. And yet, David is a man after God's own heart. So how is it that his intentional sin was atoned for? Now in verse 2, the Hebrew word chatat, or sin offering, comes from the Hebrew word chata, which means to miss the mark. And going back to the idea that this was to address unintentional sin, it really didn't matter if you didn't intend to miss the mark. The point is, you missed the mark. And so there is some way to reconcile that. But again, going back to the issue of David, for instance, how is intentional sin atoned for? And in other words, what I'm getting at is it possible that God went through all of these different rituals and different specifics about how to address unintentional sin to accentuate the fact that intentional sin is not addressed? And wouldn't that beg the question of, well, how do we deal with these things? Which leads us into verse 3, because we have in verse 3 some verses that deal with the anointed priest, which is another way of saying the high priest, and if he sins. But what's interesting is that the Hebrew that is translated anointed priest is HaKohen HaMashiach. Let me say it again. HaKohen, the priest, HaMashiach, the anointed. Literally, the Messiah, the priest. If he sins, in other words, as you read this, his sin would affect the entire congregation of Israel. And so he's got to atone for his own transgressions, because it's for the sake of the people, not just for him as an individual, but for the sake of the whole nation. And so as we read, we see that he takes this bull, this bullock that is offered on his behalf, and he takes the blood and he goes inside the holy place and he sprinkles the blood toward the veil that separated the Holy of Holies from the holy place. Now, in the other sacrifices that we've dealt with, if their blood was taken into the holy place and this happened with them, that would be disqualified. Those sacrifices would be disqualified. And so, in other words, this one is unique. And because this one is the ritual or the protocol concerning the Hakohen HaMashiach. Hakohen HaMashiach. So that means that at least this part of the ritual where the anointed priest was concerned occurred in the holy place. Now, a certain portion of that sacrifice was burned upon the altar, but the skin, the carcass, etc., was taken outside the camp and it was burned in a clean place. And again, why was this done? Not just for his sake, but for the entire nation. Now, let's consider that our heavenly high priest, the Hakohen HaMashiach, if I may, he knew no sin. He didn't transgress. And yet, he who knew no sin became sin for us. Not only that, he was taken outside the camp. He was taken outside the city to the place called Golgotha, or the place of the skull. And I believe, and there's sufficient evidence for this, I'm convinced, but I believe that crucifixion occurred on the Mount of Olives. That would be east of the Temple Mount. So in a sense, his blood was sprinkled toward the temple. It does not say that the priest had to sprinkle the veil with the blood, but sprinkle toward the Holy of Holies. And so if the crucifixion occurred on the Mount of Olives, in a sense, that's what we see happening. It's definitely outside the camp. And why is he doing it? Not for his sake, but for the sake of all of Israel. And we see, according to the writer of Hebrews, that Messiah came as high priest of the good things to come. This is in Hebrews 9, verse 11 and 12. He comes as the high priest of the good things to come with the greater and more perfect tabernacle, not made with hands, that is, not of this creation, not with the blood of goats and calves, but with his own blood. He entered the most holy place once for all, having obtained eternal redemption. And so again, in the midst of all this, it has a sacrifice that deals with the Hakohen HaMashiach, the anointed priest, and how that, I believe, is hinting at Yeshua, our heavenly high priest. Again, not that he sinned, but he who knew no sin became sin for us. Now, in verse 22 of chapter 4, it says, when a ruler sins. And the term there in Hebrew is nasi. Nasi is understood to mean a prince of a tribe. This is a very, very notable person. And so when this very notable person sins and it comes to his attention, we have a situation where he is going to make a public acknowledgement of his sin. Now, here's my question for you. What do you think happens when a notable person, someone that many people know, what happens if they make a public acknowledgement of a sin? Not because they're forced into it or trapped, but because of their own volition, they make a public acknowledgement of their sin. What is the reaction of the public going to typically be? And depending on what the reaction would be to that notable person, this Nasi, acknowledging their sin in public, depending on the reaction of others, I want to say is going to be exposing their heart. In other words, if a Nasi voluntarily makes acknowledgement of his sin and people react in a very negative way, snickering, talking behind his back, etc., that exposes what's in their heart. Or if somebody in the public responds by saying, you know what, that's admirable, that's honorable, I respect that, that's going to expose what's in their heart. So could it be that many of these sacrifices, and especially those that were considered to be voluntary, that when these sacrifices are brought and these gifts are brought, that in some cases, yes, it deals with the individual and God, but is it also possible that in dealing with the individual, that God is also exposing those who aren't willing to do those things? Something to consider. Now in chapter 5, it talks about other different offerings, including the Ashram, which is the guilt offering. But in verse 1, it says that anyone with facts that have bearing on a legal situation or know something about a certain situation or dispute, and they keep silent, that person is guilty. And in fact, the word that's used in verse 1 is Allah, Aleph Lamed Hey, Allah. And that suggests that the person who keeps silent is to be subject to a curse, because the word Allah is a word that is used many times as curse. So what this suggests is that we are obligated to speak up when we have facts that could affect a situation. Now, we're not talking about slander. We're not talking about hearsay or gossip or lashon hara. We're talking about factual information. In other words, what should you do if you know someone is headed into a dangerous situation or into a dangerous association or a dangerous relationship, and you know you have fact? What should you do? Well, what I'm seeing in this, if you have fact, then you're obligated to speak up, not to spread gossip, not to undermine. If you do it in the attempt to get back at somebody, then once again, your heart is going to be exposed. But this is, I believe, addressing those situations where you have facts that have bearing on a situation, and it could be a bad outcome for somebody if you don't say something. Now, I want you to also consider what this says or suggests prophetically, and that is in regard to Allah. Now, the word Aleph Lamed Hey, Allah, means curse. But interestingly, the name of the Islamic deity is pronounced exactly the same way. It's just spelled with an additional lamed. So, in other words, what I'm getting at is, does this directive in the Torah also obligate us to speak out about some other things that we see coming down the pipe, coming over the horizon? In other words, does this hint at that we are to be watchmen? And as watchmen, we have certain obligations. And of course, those obligations are, if you see some things are about to happen and you don't speak up and the people suffer, they'll be carried away in their sins, but you will have their blood on your hands. But if you do speak up and you, now we're talking speaking truth, and they don't listen, well, then they're carried away in their iniquity and their blood is on their own hands. But then it also acknowledges that some people will listen and will be saved. So just something to consider, that this is not only speaking in terms of civil issues, but I believe we could take the principle and apply it to prophetic issues as well. Now in verse 2 and 3, it talks about people who come in contact with unclean things, the uncleanness of man, etc., that they are to present an asham, an offering, a guilt offering. In verse 6, we have a situation where a sin offering, a chatat, is to express inward conciliation. In other words, the chatat, the sin offering, deals with what's going on the inside, our inward remorse, whereas the asham, the guilt offering, deals with the outward effect of the transgression. In other words, what starts on the inside manifests on the outside. And even though we can go to God and deal with what's going on the inside, unfortunately, what happened on the outside can sometimes have ripple effect. In other words, it can have an effect on somebody else, on your family, on the company you work for, the congregation you're part of, etc. In other words, one's going to deal with the inward, but you still got to deal with the outward. In verse 8, for instance, when the olah is being presented, the burnt offering, the gift, before it can be received, the sin offering must be dealt with first. In other words, you've got to be reconciled to the Creator before God's going to receive your gift. But now consider that in addition to you must love the Lord your God with all of your heart, you also have to love your neighbor as yourself. So here's what I'm getting at. In the words of Yeshua in Matthew 5, verse 23, he says, "Therefore, if you bring your gift to the altar, and there remember that your brother has something against you, leave your gift there before the altar and go your way. First, be reconciled to your brother, and then come and offer your gift." In other words, look, you you want to come to God for forgiveness, okay. But you need to go to your fellow man and seek his forgiveness if there is that animosity. Then God's going to deal with your relationship with him. But you've got to deal with the internal and you've got to deal with the external. You can't do one and leave the other undone. The rabbis teach that on Yom Kippur, a man's sins against God are atoned for. But for sins against fellow man, they are not atoned for until the offender has made restitution with his fellow man. And again, Yeshua addresses this principle in Matthew chapter 6, verse 14. For if you forgive men their trespasses, your heavenly Father will also forgive you. But if you do not forgive men their trespasses, neither will your Father forgive your trespasses. Now in verse 14, again, it mentions the asham, the guilt offering. And like others, this one deals with unintentional sins. And particularly this one is dealing with when someone has unintentionally appropriated to his own use some holy thing. Now in verse 21, it talks about committing a trespass against the Lord when you deal falsely with your neighbor. In other words, anyone hiding the fact that they have their neighbor's property is denying God, because you see, God is a witness to this situation. In other words, in the context, it talks about leaving a deposit. If somebody gives you something and they are wanting you to hold it or take care of it for them for whatever reason, and the only people who know about it are you and that other person, well, you could lie and deny it. And if there's no physical evidence to suggest that you do have this property, then you could potentially get away with it. But in denying that and dealing falsely with your neighbor, you're committing a trespass against the Lord, because God is witness to the situation. Now notice, this is intentional. And in fact, this constitutes robbery. And every person that does this is committing robbery, even a person who intends to replace that they are taking. In fact, if they are found out, or if they come forward and they make all of this known, not only are they to replace that they took, but they're to add a fifth to it. And so this, ladies and gentlemen, is considered very serious, because one of the first sins that is condemned is robbery. One of the first sins that we see in the world is robbery. Not the first, but one of the first. And we see that in Cain, because Cain robbed his brother of his life. In fact, the word Cain comes from the term kana, which means to acquire. And in this particular context, Cain chose to acquire by force. He was a robber, because a thief and a robber doesn't come in through the door, which, by the way, is how the bondservant comes into the house. But how does a thief and a robber come? By some other way. So, in other words, Cain would not respond to God's invitation to do the right thing because he didn't have the right heart. He had the heart of a robber, of a murderer, of a liar, all the things that typify the serpent. And so as we come to the end of this Torah portion, all of this has been to say, all these different requirements, rituals, laws, etc., that unfortunately most people tend to look at that and not beyond. But what we see in this, ladies and gentlemen, is that God is wanting to know, what's in your heart? Do you have a heart after me? In other words, how was David's sin, intentional sin, dealt with? I believe the key is in the fact that David was a man after God's own heart. The distinctions between Saul and David are this: both are anointed, both are king, both have a calling, both have gifts, they're prophets, they prophesy, etc. But the distinction is this: when confronted with his sin, Saul tried to make excuses. When confronted with his sin, David repented. The difference was not so much by what you see on the outside, because in some ways what David did on the outside was far worse, seemingly, than what Saul did. But yet, the distinction is made by what's on the inside, what was in their heart. And so through this sacrificial system, ultimately, that is what the God of Israel is looking for, to see What's in your heart? Thank you for joining me today. Shalom.
Like what you're hearing? Become a BillCloud Premium Partner to watch or listen to hundreds of hours of teachings and resources on demand. Go to BillCloud.com/subscribe to start watching today.